Hey there, I'm Lauren Fates, and I love a parade.
And I'm Jamie Sanchez. My Electra Halloween costume is now a couples cosplay.
Ooh, are you ready for the beat?
I'm ready for that beat.
Welcome back, bounty hunters, to the Bebop Beat. Jamie just completely took me by surprise there. Is your partner being Vincent for Halloween?
He is. When I first said, hey, I'm going to be Electra for Halloween and you should be Vincent, he said, no way, I don't look like that guy. And I pulled up a screenshot on my phone and he hasn't cut his curly hair in the last 20 months. So, and he's got that little bit of scruff on his face. And he said, oh.
You haven't gotten a haircut. These are the consequences.
I think the worst is he'll have to find a bolo tie and one of those witch hats, but he pretty much fits the bill.
Oh, I can give you a great tutorial for a giant homemade witch hat if you want. I was actually Taco from the Adventure Zone at a couple of live events, and I made quite the wizard hat. I could really hook you up.
Yeah, please send me that pattern.
In the meantime, I only have one little update I want to talk about. This happened a while ago, but I don't think we mentioned it here. The U2's toy line has come out with a limited edition Cowboy Bebop line of figurines. I think they're super cute. They're about $20 each. And what's funny about them is how they got around drawing anime eyes on any of these characters. Anime eyes are not really the style of U2's. U2's normally does like YouTubers, and they started out with a lot of online personalities, and now they're going into more licensed series. So Faye's wearing sunglasses, and the rest of them are kind of doing this like smiley chibi anime face that makes that like half C shape for their eyes. So none of them have really open eyes. It's just a funny art choice. I really love Ed. I think the hair is super cute. I really like the pose of Spike, but $20 times five is actually a lot. So I don't know which one I should pick. I don't think I can make the whole investment.
So this is like another Funko Pops kind of line?
It is. They're very much like Funko Pops, but it's a competitor's brand. And they got their start basically by making figurines of people that Funko maybe wouldn't, like YouTube stars. I don't think Funko has really dipped into that pool. So if you want your like Try Guys or I don't know, Markiplier, maybe Markiplier has one. I just pulled that out of nowhere. But yeah, that's who gets to be a U2's. They also have animal ones. Like if you've seen some popular animal TikToks or Vines, even those have gotten to be U2's. But I guess they're doing anime now.
Count me out. I've run out of room in my collection space, but along with all of the beautiful statues that are coming out soon and all of the many like Spike figurines that are out on the market already, I can't justify that.
Yeah, I guess I didn't even think of it until this very moment, but there are Cowboy Bebop Funko Pops. So this is like another line of figurines of that material and size, just a different brand.
Capitalism!
Yay, capitalism!
So this is part two of our movie discussion, and we're picking up where we last left off last episode with the battle on the train. So far, we've talked about the first half of the movie and many of its kind of backstories about our characters, the details of the world at large, and a little bit of about Sakuga, which we'll get into later. But now we want to really give a chance at the science fiction elements of this story and maybe what makes it a little less fiction now that we're in the year 2021. So I'd like to introduce our guest today. Chise is a senior scientist in vaccine research and development. Welcome to the show, Chise.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much for having me.
We're so excited to have you here as a guest expert because this is a terrifying film about the spread of nanobots and the societal reaction to that incident. And in 2021, obviously that feels really different for all of us. And you have some extremely personal experience with COVID-19 and vaccines. Would you tell us a little bit about your work?
Absolutely. So I had a hand in developing Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine. And you guys know that the difference with these vaccines compared to your traditional vaccines is that these guys used mRNA technology. So for what a lot of people don't know is that your traditional vaccine doesn't utilize mRNA like these do. mRNA literally is a template strand that teaches your immune system, or I should say gives your immune system a blueprint of a sort as to how to manufacture a spike protein. And when I say that, a lot of people, you know, usually will kind of freak out and they're like, well, isn't the spike protein, you know, the harmful component of coronavirus? Which, yes, it is. However, the great thing is about the vaccines is that it teaches your immune system to make this and not harm you. So you're kind of, in a sense, uploading, you know how you upload software to a computer and you teach it what it needs to learn, or it kind of like gathers those components. In a sense, that's what the mRNA tech does. Your cells will read the mRNA strand, memorizes it, knows how to identify a spike protein, produces it. Your cells sit there and attack it when it needs to. And then when you come into contact with the virus, your cells sit there and remember, hey, I know this guy. I know what to do when I see something that looks like this, and reacts from there. So this technology, while a lot of people, I guess it's new to the public, but it's really not new to us. In other words, we've been working on, you know, mRNA vaccines for, you know, over a decade, and have, you know, over a decade of research for these coronavirus vaccines, you know, going back to the original SARS. So new to the public, but not quite new to us.
It being new to the public is absolutely right. There's a lot of fear out there and, frankly, misinformation. And even just now, you did such a great job giving us the like software upload metaphor to make what you do easier to understand. Communicating complex science concepts is so important to get, you know, public buy-in and public participation, and yet it fails. Why do you think that is? And what is the work you're doing online? We see you often talking about this on Twitter, for example, to help educate people.
You guys know that I am in a fandom of sorts myself. I mean, you know, I love anime. I dive into different fandoms. However, I saw people within the fandoms that I'm in my community kind of struggling to make sense of all of this. Scientific jargon is really difficult. And it took me years, you know, in school and even through experience at work to fully grasp some of these concepts. You know, immunology, virology, even vaccinology is very complex, and it's a lot to fully comprehend sometimes. The way that I made it through school was to sit here and take these scientific journals, and I would break them down to make them easier on myself. I would, you know, look up the terms, you know, break it down into, you know, just a couple of sentences to try and make sense of it to make it easier to understand. And while that was something that worked out for me, you know, and my experience over the years, I thought that it could help people online. Truth be told, we worked a lot of weekends last year. The entire genome of the coronavirus was kind of disassembled and, you know, worked on over a span of 2 days in March. That's how fast this information traveled at the time. So what I was doing was I would literally take out my phone and I would open my notes app, and I just started taking notes and writing stuff down, you know, just typing away. What could I help people, you know, make it through? What could I help them understand? Whether it was how the mRNA vaccines worked, or what was dangerous about a coronavirus, or the ingredients in the vaccines, things like that, that people didn't understand at the time. And that's literally how it started. Just started with screenshots. Then all of a sudden I was like, you know what I can do? I can take these papers, whether it's coming from us or whether it's coming from other labs, to sit there and break it down as to what they're finding, what they're researching, and their results. And it just kind of took off from there. So the thing is that what I do online is completely outside of my job, but I try to fit it in where possible.
I think one of the aspects why your tweets are so impactful is because you do present more as an anonymous figure in the scientific community online. I believe you're part of the furry community. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So when it comes to fandom, it's easier for fans to relate to others like themselves instead of, you know, nameless government figures doing a really poor job at communicating these really important issues. So as someone who promotes fandom and believes that fans can be both professional and enjoy the thing that they love, you know, it shouldn't affect their career, Do you get to be as open about your identity or interests in your work environment? And do you think your colleagues think differently of you about the media you enjoy?
So that's actually a really good question. And a lot of people don't realize, a lot of my coworkers don't exactly know the fandom that I'm in. I can't tell you that really if anybody saw my page that they would even know who I was. So either I do a fairly good job of masking it, or I just don't always put it out there, if that makes sense. You know, at my desk, I'm sure a couple people will probably catch on. I've got, you know, Demon Slayer stuff, you know, at my desk, so little figurines, you know, and stickers and stuff of that sort. But I don't think anybody ever catches on that, oh, she's in the furry fandom or she's into this. It's just everybody decorates their little area. But I don't think anybody ever catches on in that sense. So a lot of people don't know what it is that I do on Twitter. And to be honest with you, I kind of prefer to keep it that way. Mostly because the internet can be a really great place, but it can also be a harsh place. So people, you know, within the fandom and my friends within the fandom knew what I did. You know, they knew that I was a scientist, knew that I was in vaccine development, and, you know, would know that what I did on a daily basis. However, when COVID came around, it was almost as if my fandom interests and my work collided. And where I say that it collided was because literally just started out trying to help people within the fandom understand and make sense of all this. You know, people were afraid, people were frightened, they were uncertain. I all of a sudden had professors and I had doctors and I had other scientists from other labs. And I've even had people who are in government positions start to follow me and retweet my tweets. And that's kind of where this all took off. So I'm not exactly sure that some people who retweet my tweets understand that, you know, oh, she's an anonymous account. But then, of course, when you see people within the fandom, that's just always something that we do. A lot of us call each other by, you know, our fandom names. Some people might not even know each other's real names. That's just how it is. And they've always, you know, associated with what one would call a persona. So I think some people had an issue with the fact that I was anonymous, but I was like, you know, this is literally just been my, you know, fandom account that I've used. Again, people at work, some people might know my interests, but not fully. And again, I like to keep it that way, but tweeting things like this kind of merged that all together more so than I expected it to.
That's still so cool. I'm just going to put that out there. I'm a fan of being a professional and being just a giant anime fan. I don't think the two need to be exclusive of each other, though.
I absolutely agree. I totally agree. Because you will have people who will say, oh, why should I take her word? She's in the furry fandom. And I'm like looking like I didn't realize that that had an impact on anything that I said or anything that I shared. But okay. I think people fail to realize that even as a doctor or a scientist or a researcher, you still have your interests. You're still a person too. If anything, I think some positive aspects that came out of this is that people realize that, yeah, people who are in the furry fandom, you know, can have some fantastic professions and they can, you know, they can branch out, they can help people. Like, we're not just people that like to go to conventions and hang out with others and have fun. We're definitely still professionals too.
Well, we brought you here for a lot of reasons, but one of them is to get your professional opinion on how realistic or not the movie Knockin' on Heaven's Door is about when a contagion hits a society. So I actually unboxed this a little bit in the last episode, but we cut it for time, so we're bringing it to you. The bioterrorism, if you will, that happens in the Cowboy Bebop movie is a big mystery for most of the film. We first just sort of see people scared of sneezing. They're not knowing what the nature of the spread is. That feels extremely familiar right now.
Absolutely.
We learn in the back half of the film that it's not actually a virus. It's not actually bacteria. What we're dealing with is nanobots that can spread through touch or the air. There is a hallucination component. People see butterflies when the machines reach their brain. There are lymph reactions, and then the nanobots turn into protein and leave the body without a trace. Obviously, heavy science fiction here. But the way this can kind of tie back to real life is, do you think a virus or a contagion could possibly spread and kill this quickly?
So that's actually a really good question. You would have to look at different viruses that can have a certain impact and how well they spread and what their properties are. When it comes to the movie, could something like that spread that quickly? Not quite. This does dive into more science fiction, which is great because I love it. I mean, the movie was fantastic, but it depends on the virus that you are dealing with and how it is transmitted. When we talk about respiratory viruses like COVID or any coronavirus for that matter, like you were just saying, we're sneezing. Let's be honest. Does anybody else sit there and almost have your heart skip a beat if you hear someone sneezing near you or someone coughing near you?
Now I do. Yeah,
oh, yeah, I'm terrified.
You know, it's something that's just kind of psychological to a point where maybe back when, you know, this before this all happened, maybe you didn't think anything of it. But now it's like your brain is kind of wired to where you hear it and you're like, where did that come from? Do they have a mask on? How close are they to me? And that's where we are today with this. And it's super unfortunate because, you know, nobody should have to be afraid, but that's what we're dealing with right now. When it comes to how transmittable a virus is, I don't think anything that we know of right now would ever reach anything that we see in the movie, but there are viruses that can get close to that. When it comes to transmission, I would probably say that if we had to think of something that would get close to this level, I probably would look back and say, yeah, Ebola transmits very, very quickly. However, what works out in a lot of people's favor is that it has to sit there and transmit a specific way, as Ebola doesn't travel through, you know, aerosol droplets that you might sneeze. It travels through, you know, bodily fluids, blood, you know, that kind of thing. So in that aspect, I guess I could put it to ease like this. COVID does not transmit as fast as what we see in this movie. And I guess when it comes to certain things like this, I guess we're going to start getting into like medical response and containment of such a thing, which I can definitely dive into because that's definitely important when we're talking about COVID or any respiratory virus for that matter.
Having lived through this experience in late 2019 and early 2020 and seeing how COVID really wasn't well handled and the outbreak started to spread internationally, and then comparing it to the film we watched, in which we see perhaps a government also botching an outbreak containment. Do you think that society handled the outbreak in the film well? Do you think that this was a valid medical response or civilian response in regards to something of this scale? And then, you know, later on, the film brings in military responses because they are dealing with a terrorist attack. Could this have been portrayed a little better, or do you think it was well handled?
So I think in the movie, it was well handled to a certain extent when it came to like civilian response in a way, but like you said, government botching it in a sense, which if you guys remember, let's go back to, I'm not going to say the end of 2019, but I'm going to say 2020. I think there was some intelligence about it earlier, probably like December, maybe even November 2019, but you didn't really hear much about it. Communication is really big when it comes to such a thing. And unfortunately, the response was not very good when it came to COVID. I'm going to say that for us in the States. I think other countries might have had a little bit of better response than we did, but here it was considered to not be a big deal or that it would go away within, you know, 2 weeks. And unfortunately, we could see that that was something that did not happen at all. So kind of trying to relate the response in the movie to how we dealt with it here, kind of similar in a sense, unfortunately.
So let's start unboxing the movie from where we left off. After this train terror attack, the second explosion, the second mass casualty event of civilians, we have Jet decide he's out. This is too big for bounty hunters. And like I was saying on the last episode, Jet had a very specific idea of what being a bounty hunter was going to be like. And it was not this. He does not want to deal with something of this danger level, this political level. He is out. I actually think this is a pretty big revelation for our characters to put in the film. We got through the entire anime without Jet really having this sort of come to Jesus moment. And I really appreciate that the creators of Bebop got the opportunity to visit this this psychological point with Jet.
But we also learned that while Jet is giving Spike a pass, you know, we could just walk away from this bounty and pretend like it never happened and not be wrapped up in any of this. He doubles down. He's in this now because maybe in part he sees a bit of himself in Vincent, or maybe he is attracted to or connected with Elektra on some level. But yeah, this movie isn't going to end with us just being like, Spike peacing out on the couch, reading some like pulpy magazine like he's wont to do. No, he's going to go for the big bad and we're going to have giant battle scenes at the end.
Speaking of Elektra, Elektra gets pretty much blamed for these deaths. And the question I have for you, Jamie, is do we think Vincent was going to execute this terror attack on the train regardless? Was that his plan all along? Or did it happen because Elektra cornered him? I'm not sure. It's not her fault regardless. I'm not going to blame her regardless. I'm not ready to say he was going to do that on his own. Or was it a reaction because he was about to get caught?
The first tanker explosion seemed to also happen for no such reason. So I presume this is just him testing the waters in regards to whether that's civilian response or you know, seeing if he's going to trigger some kind of military uprising or, you know, just what terrorists do. They breed terror. This is his chance to really put his foot in the ground and say, like, no, I'm a real threat.
And that's a good point. In terms of what we saw in our own lives for quarantine shutdown, a plot point like that doesn't happen in this movie. The fact that they still end up having the Halloween parade after that explosion is so wild to me. Like, we are experiencing the fastest, deadliest contagion that I think in this world is like ever been known to society. And they just go, well, that sucks. Happy Halloween.
It feels a little real though. Like, let's be honest. So now that Spike has doubled down on figuring out what the hell is going on, he goes back to Moroccan Street to find Rashid and maybe get some more answers out of him. This is where we learn that Rashid is actually Mendelo, a scientist who built this nanomachine, customized this virus, and likely worked for Chirius Medical.
But Chirius is, I guess, not a medical company at all. They were making nano war machines, and they experimented on Vincent.
And if we remember the events of Jupiter Jazz and everything that Gren went to, we now have this full backstory that there were actually no enemies in the Titan War. It was just everyone killing each other for the sake of military advancement. And wow, that is so garbage. Like, this is probably the biggest bit of soul lore that we've heard so far that has rippled everywhere across Mars, that affects everybody who was involved in that war. And it really gives you a sense of how much effort the creators went into making this like a holistic story without just shoveling it into your face right off the bat.
And I'm taking a pretty big swing here, I admit that. But knowing that this is what the Titan War actually was, and seeing characters like Gren and characters like Vincent, whose lives were permanently altered, they suffered immense trauma, it makes sense why normal people would have hesitancy about things like vaccine rollouts, because if their own government in this science fiction world is like known to have conducted these experiments, why would you trust them? I kind of get it. I'm vaccinated in real life, but there's like a grain of truth there that the sins of the past would start to affect public reactions in the future.
So everything that unfolds after this scene where we learn about Mendelo kind of rolls into the big climax of the movie. Vincent's getting ready for the festival. He's dressed in a warlock outfit. Faye has her bearings now and is immune to this nanobot terrorist attack. You feel this two-hour film is finally done setting the stage and is ready to change gears. The calming backgrounds grounded us, and now our characters are ramping up action. And the movie's creators are priming us for some very intense battle sequences in their big finale.
So when we left Elektra, she had discovered that for some reason, unknown to her, she's immune to these nanomachines. She ends up going to her workplace, Chirius Medical, and wants to get her own blood tested to see what's up with her own body, and I guess potentially how she could help the world with what is unique about her. So she flirts with this poor, like, lab guy named Steve, and he, I mean, frankly, like, tries to leverage a date out of it. It's not great, but Steve agrees to fast-track testing Elektra's blood with the hopes of making some kind of cure for what is killing people. This was one of the reasons I was really excited to talk to Chise, because it just seems like a lot of steps might get skipped here. Like, we have your blood and now we have a vaccine. So what are the actual steps that are taken when a new contagion is discovered? And what does it take to develop a vaccine? Big question, I know.
Indeed. And I do wish that developing a vaccine was actually that easy. If it was only that simple. Most vaccines can take, you know, anywhere from 10 to 15 years to develop when you, you know, pile on all of your research and then you go through your preclinical studies and then, of course, your phase 1, 2, and 3 studies, you know, with humans. So it takes some time. And I think that was one of the big things when it came to these COVID-19 vaccines. You know, a lot of people were like, how did you develop them so quickly? And, you know, kind of failed to realize, again, as I was, you know, telling you guys earlier, these vaccines are built on over a decade plus of research. When you're doing mRNA vaccine production, you are working on quite a big scale. You're going into drug substance production, you know, you're looking at plasmid production, your drug substance formulation and bulk fill. You have a bunch of steps that you go through to develop a vaccine. Now, the good thing is that when it comes to mRNA vaccines and where you're looking, like, let's take, for example, our influenza vaccines, or I'm going to say our traditional vaccines, where you have to work, you know, to culture the virus. And you normally you'll see with influenza vaccines that they've utilized, you know, chicken embryos to sit there and do these. mRNA vaccines take some of that heavy work out, into the extent that you don't have to go through all those steps, so you can manufacture them and produce them faster. But I don't want people to sit there and think that, you know, that doesn't mean that a lot of work doesn't go into them, because it does. And a big thing is that because RNA is so fragile when we're dealing with, you know, manufacturing our nanolipid particles to pretty much encase that strand, a lot of steps go into making sure that that is completely protected, because that's, I mean, that's your, you know, your main factor of this vaccine. So a lot of time and work goes into it. And while the movie was fantastic for, you know, the fact that Elektra could sit there and, you know, study her blood and, you know, work on a cure, it's not quite that simple for vaccines like these. And I would say one thing that I did want to sit there and relate on, what does help with development of these vaccines is looking at people who have, for example, had a previous infection. A lot of the studies that you see, you know, coming out from labs, especially when it comes to, you know, determining like how long immunity will last, or if someone has memory cells, you know, for a long period of time, we've sat there and, you know, looked at people who might have had a previous SARS infection and how it helps them to this day when it comes to SARS-CoV-2, or how long their immunity has lasted since they've gotten infected with the original SARS. Like, for example, there's a person, I think might have been a couple of people, that still have memory cells to this day. I think, when was that outbreak? That was 2003. So you're looking at, you know, 17 plus later, years later, that someone still has an immune response from the previous infection of SARS.
In this film, we are talking about nanobots and how they can turn into proteins somehow. But one of the solutions to spreading the vaccine they develop from Elektra's blood is to spray it across the parade through an airborne technique. So just to fast forward a little bit, they rent these biplanes and spread the vaccine through the air. How likely is it for a vaccine spread through the air How likely would it be to work? Can it be pervasive? Does the rain help it spread faster? Like, these are very clearly scientific questions we should be asking, but not in an anime film.
So the funny thing is that while watching this, you might think that, oh, this is completely like, you know, all sci-fi and that's not possible. There was actually an airborne vaccine, and I say airborne in quotations, that was studied and tested, measles actually, in India. They had attempted to utilize somewhat of an airborne vaccine. The thing is, though, is that unfortunately, while one could wish and hope that something would, you know, work out so well as it did in the movie, unfortunately, they don't work so well like that in real life. What they did find is that most people who, you know, were in this study, it turns out that they didn't seroconvert. It didn't really work too well with their system. And unfortunately, they were still vulnerable to measles. Airborne doesn't quite work out too well. So you find that the immune system responds much better to vaccines that are intramuscular, or should they administered in your muscle instead.
So to Lauren's point earlier, to circle back, I'm pretty certain an airborne vaccine also would be very unethical in general. And it makes me wonder how our characters get away with this, you know, blanketing an entire parade without the government's consent or anyone's consent with the vaccine that's supposedly going to counteract the nanobots that they've been exposed to from this terrorist attack. My question for you, Chisei, is there actually a history of mass vaccination in a government or in a country that wasn't consensual?
Pretty sure one of the biggest ones that we're probably going to talk about would be polio, because polio was so detrimental, you know, back in the 1950s. But when you think about it today, certain mandates have been put into place in certain countries. And I think, well, actually, you know what? I take that back. One was just put into place where federal employees were required to be vaccinated. And then I think other employers who had employees of 100 or more had to sit there and put a mandate in place, or employees would have to be tested weekly. So throughout history, depending on what country you're in, certain mandates have been put into place to be vaccinated. The thing is, though, is that, again, like you were saying, you know, before, ethics comes into place where you can't force someone to get vaccinated, which I think is where we also hit, you know, a lot of bumps in the road today, because I think the worst thing that you can do is mandate something, but then not communicate well enough to your public about the vaccines or the need for these or how much they help. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we're dealing with today. Because if you're going to mandate something, you're going to want to sit there and give everyone, you know, all the information that you could possibly be able to give.
The meeting with Mendelo ends up getting Spike caught. Mendelo does this super radical, like, Tony Hawk grind and slides out of the scene down the railing, and then Spike is surrounded by soldiers. He ends up in a cell immediately next to Elektra, because in a huge act of, like, employer retaliation, Elektra's locked up because she is immune. They think she's involved somehow. Apparently, her confiding in Steve resulted in her kind of getting ratted out. I wish she could call HR or something. That doesn't seem okay. But this is where we get the famous scene between Spike and Elektra talking about their pasts. These are two heartbroken people who are still alive, maybe living through their not ideal scenario about how things were going to turn out. Spike doesn't get to be with Julia at this time, is searching for her. Elektra, it went bad with Vincent, and now he is what he is. And they're both trapped. We went over this a little bit with Jennifer Hale in our previous episode. I highly, highly encourage you to go back and listen to that one if you haven't. But one more thing I wanted to call out from this scene was that Spike acknowledges that he and Vincent share similar souls. So some of our comparisons between those two people, even he himself seems to see it.
I would like to call out from this scene that it is super hot and I love it. And every time I watch it, I'm just like, you two should boink.
Okay. Go to horny jail, Jamie.
Sorry. Not sorry.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I take a lot of heat on social media for thinking that even though Spike is obviously very loyal to Julia, Julia's his one true love, he would never start a relationship with anyone else. I still think Spike can and probably does get it on the side and justify it. We've talked about this before, and this is a cute couple.
Also, Elektra is, I'm sorry, Lauren, way better than Julia in every way possible, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah, I love Julia, but I love Julia as a storytelling device because that's all she is. We don't know much about Julia. We know about her through the eyes of men that want her. When we finally get to meet her, spoiler alert, she doesn't hang around for that long. I actually think that's something that's getting rectified in the Netflix version, for better or worse. Julia's going to be around a lot more in the live action.
Sorry, bring Elektra in. We just went over this with Jennifer. I would love to see Elektra in the live action. Or I guess I can just go back to all the fanfic I've been reading.
Another thing we did go over already in the last episode is the nature of the Faye scenes and sexual assault, frankly. And her face has just true horror on it when she hears Spike's name and knows that Vincent is tied up with Spike and all of this. Vincent leaves her behind in his apartment because she turns down his very cool offer to like be his terrifying post-apocalyptic queen. And the line here that I want to point to is Vincent saying the rest of the world is insane. This is a very common trope, I think, for supervillains, for big bads, that they believe they're the only person who has it right at this point and they have to end it. It's beyond salvageable when they're the only sane one. Very scary. Big scary.
So at this point, Jet's still grumpy. He feels like he's been abandoned. Screw them all anyway, whatever. He doesn't need them. And they all return to the ship in this moment of climax where the story really just takes off for all these action sequences to follow. We have Spike bringing in Elektra and no one really questioning who this person is. Faye returning from being lost for over 24 hours. And Ed and Ayn also bumping around. So there's this family moment where they're kind of getting together that always really warms my heart a little bit. Maybe Jet at this point realizes that, no, he does need them. And he's going along with what seems like a solid plan to spray the parade with a nanobot vaccine.
This is where the Bebop crew really shines because everybody gets their own job that really plays to their strengths. Jet pursues the whole biplane thing. Faye is in charge of changing the weather. I think you're absolutely right, though, Jamie, with what you said earlier, that there should have been some sort of consequence for some of these things. And the movie super gets away with it. Not only is the flying of biplanes with a vaccine really ethically questionable, but Faye with like a submachine gun or something telling them to change the weather and referring to herself as a terrorist, she's going to jail. The movie gets to exist after the anime, and thus the anime never has to come back and answer for what happens after all of this. Only following this movie is basically Hard Luck Woman and The Real Folk Blues. There's no opportunity to answer for what happens here. And it's buck wild. It's the funniest part of the film and maybe the weakest part of the film.
In other episodes, we've seen, though, some hand-wavy stuff, so it doesn't bother me too much. But what I really appreciated in a scene to follow is this kind of tug of war between the ISSP and the military trying to stop Vincent's terrorist plot. They go to the sewer system thinking that that's where he'll set off his next big bomb. In reality, it's a comedic scene where our ISSP detective is just trying to lay stake in that this is his job, that they don't have the authority to be here otherwise. Wow. I mean, this is kind of the scene I think of when I think of what our government is maybe up to nowadays. It's like, who's in charge? Who gives you that authority? I'm the authority.
Yeah, not to just completely dunk on America, but this very much reminded me of some of our own government's overzealous military reactions to things. I laugh every time I watch this movie and we see those like pairs of guys on basically go-karts that get dumped out of planes. Point the first, I don't know what they think they're going to do against microscopic nanobots. You can't shoot them. What is this? But point the second, I just couldn't stop thinking about our military budget. So much R&D money had to go into the planes that dump the go-karts safely.
Last episode, we described how this film elevates and expands on the Bebop world's fascinating details. Today, we're diving deeper into how its creators made that happen. We interviewed Liberec, writer and admin for Sakugaboru.com, over email about what viewers should know. They define Sakuga as, quote, drawing pictures, but more specifically, animation. Western fans have long since appropriated the word to refer to instances of particularly good animation in the same way that a subset of Japanese fans do, end quote. Scenes classified as Sakuga follow the same processes as regular animation, starting from the choreography and pacing in storyboards, then key animation and in-betweens, with many correction processes in between each phase. The key differentiators from non-Sakuga scenes are expanded budget, longer production timeline, and the work of high-level experts. Liberec pointed out that animation studios in the late 90s were transitioning to digital processes. Quote, therefore, this movie is Bones' last project in which the animation was colored by painting directly on cells. Every subsequent work was painted digitally, end quote. Bones has a history of great work and excellent in-house talent. We asked Liberec what he admired most about this film. He said, quote, each animator could showcase their skills in scenes suitable for them, which is unfortunately not often the case. Also, the experimentation with digital effects by Mitsuo Iso, who was ahead of his time back then, end quote. Note that Iso worked on the butterfly effect scenes and the first-person distortion scenes when both Faye and Spike were affected by nanobots. We asked Liberec about specific Sakuga scenes from this film to gain a deeper understanding behind each, and he mentions a dozen animators, all worth following on Sakugaboru, so hang in for this data dump. Quote, it's worth noting that Yutaka Nakamura was the action storyboard artist and animation supervisor on this movie. He shaped the action animation and choreography. The opening and ending animation was handled separately from the main movie. It was storyboarded and directed by Hiroyuki Okiura, who's the director of Jinro and A Letter to Momo, and animated by him and Tetsuya Nishio. They're among the best representatives of realism in animation, which you can see in these sequences. The cheeriest battle between Elektra and Spike was animated by Yoshihiko Umokishi and Nurumitsu Suzuki, who have both been recently working on My Hero Academia. The former is known for his idiosyncratic drawing style and character designs, and the latter for his flawless portrayal of three-dimensional space. The John Wayne replica film was storyboarded and animated by Tensai Okamura, now known as the director of Darker Than Black or Wolf's Rain. The train battle was handled mainly by the supervisor Yutaka Nakamura himself. He's perhaps the most popular and influential action animator of this era, so even people not familiar with this animation tend to recognize this name. Norimitsu Suzuki also helped out here. The final battle was animated by Masahiro Ando, an action specialist who is now active in directing duties such as Sword of the Stranger, and Yoshiyuki Ito, who remains an animator, currently character designer and chief animation supervisor of the case study of Vanitas. Lastly, I'd like to highlight the aerial spaceship battle animated by mechanical animation specialists, or legends even, Masami Goto, Ichiro Itano, and Yasushi Muraki. End quote. Whew, that is a lot to know. So big thanks to Liberec for your time and expertise on this topic. Also, huge thanks to Sakugaboru for their extensive glossary, database, and analyses of anime production.
The last Sakuga scene that really stands out is the one-on-one Spike versus Vincent fight. Vincent says he intentionally didn't kill Spike on the train, and that really struck me because we often have conversations about whether or not Spike's actions are intentional or lucky, and Vincent is really selling, like, I'm in control. Absolutely, I made that choice. He doesn't let us question whether or not he's thinking a couple of steps ahead. Elektra shows up when it looks like Spike is beaten. She shoots Vincent, and that's where we get the line, the only time that was real was when I was with you. This is a beautiful scene. Even though it's incredibly violent, there's fireworks, like amazing planet-shaped fireworks in the background. The butterflies look so gorgeous. And I'm just really impressed by the balance here. The balance between this Sakuga brawl where every punch feels real. I was truly worried that Spike Spiegel was going to get murdered. And then just the visual beauty of the set and the lost love between these two people. Great film climax.
So Lauren, what life do you think Spike is on? I think I counted 8 so far.
I was going to say, if he's on Cat 9 lives, it has to be 8. And I don't want to get into the real folk blues. But don't you think it has to be 8?
I think I've counted at least 6 on-screen deaths of his so far. So just throw 2 more in there and we're at 8. We're treated to an ending much like the opening, where we see these really beautiful shots of humans that live in Alba City. You know, we've already seen the 3 old dudes and Laughing Bull throughout this movie. We've seen Punch and Judy. Cowboy Andy made an appearance. Even the head shop guy from episode 2, Stray Dog Strut, he's in one of the backgrounds. And it's just there to end cap this entire beautiful live world that Sunrise and Bones built together. There's so much detail. It really comes alive. And you get a sense that our characters on the Bebop live in an inhabited future.
Take note during the credits, by the way, there is a little boy who is wearing a shirt that says Bones on the back with a picture of a bone. And until I watched the credits, I didn't actually know what Bones was. So I had a split second where I was like, that cute kid is super into dinosaurs. Whoops.
The very end of the film ends with Spike in his monologue again about a guy who's alone, and we see a butterfly in his field of vision. And it leads me to believe that perhaps some viruses might be able to distort your vision. He's already living in a dream, and he already has an eye that is not his own. Is this real or is it fake? Is there a reason he should be seeing this butterfly after supposedly being vaccinated? What do we think about that ending?
What I got out of this was tied into that end sting that instead of "See you, space cowboy," we read, "Are you living in the real world?" I reflected on this a lot, and I don't think Spike would have to be living such a lonely, sad life if he didn't choose it. He's got people around him who are willing to be his chosen family, willing to give him not only a job and a home, but frankly, love. And if he is rather going to be stuck on the pursuit of Julia, stuck on revenge against Vincent, stuck on whatever fate he believes is predestined for himself, he's not living in the present. And so what I think this is a commentary on that. It's saying Spike's not necessarily living in the real world. He's living in the version of reality that he wants to believe, that he wants to pursue. And maybe we all have that. Maybe we just all have a version of events that we believe is the truth, and we're reacting to it accordingly. I think Vincent was doing a similar thing. Vincent was living in a past in the Titan War and living with the consequences of losing Elektra. And maybe he could have chosen a different path, but he chose what he chose. I think the question, are you living in the real world, is like, what are you doing? How are you reacting to your circumstances? And the fact that that isn't always what other people are doing as well. Does that make sense? Not really.
I take some of these things to be a little bit more cool, right? We've talked about Watanabe trying to make and play up the cool factor as much as possible. And this is just a nice narrative end cap to the film that I don't think it's saying much other than that, right? They're just implying that Spike is also in a dream, and we've already heard it. And I wish I could go deeper, Lauren, but every time I try, my brain just stops.
I think that's the difference between you and me, and I think the truth is somewhere in the middle, right? Like, you are always very willing to look at some of the things that Cowboy Bebop is doing and be like, Cowboy Bebop's just trying to be edgy right now. Cowboy Bebop's just trying to be cool. And then I'm like, no, it's really saying something about the human experience and something about the soul. And I bet It's somewhere in between.
Chisei, as an anime fan, where do you land on this spectrum?
Like, define what spectrum we're talking about. Like,
anime is cool versus anime is deep.
That's so hard because it depends on what I'm watching and what anime it is. Because there are so, okay, I think my biggest one right now, like, I've been catching up on My Hero Academia. I was not into it when it first came out, but man, it's like I have fallen head first. So there are some that I'm just like, man, this is super deep and I love this and I can think about this every day and that's how I want to be. So like one that I'm like, yeah, that was really cool and I enjoyed it and I'll watch it every now and again. But there are some that just hit a little bit harder. It depends.
And in regards to the film's intent, do you feel either way?
In that sense, when it comes to this film, I mean, come on, who doesn't like Spike? I'm sorry. Spike is like one of my all-time favorite anime characters, I'm going to have to say. Like if I had to sit there and name like top five, he's definitely one. But when it comes to the film, there were some parts that really struck fairly deep. So for this, in Cowboy Bebop, you know, terms or references, I'm going to say that this one is like, it's past the cool. It's more so deep to me.
That's fair. I can be wrong.
It's totally okay.
Whereas like Evangelion, it's definitely in the deep zone.
Oh my God.
It is
I can't.
Philosophically mired.
Yeah, that one will, I mean, it's a great anime, but literally it will start to fry my brain if I pay attention to it too much. I'm just like, I can't go down this road today. I got to stop myself.
So Lauren, did you get your answer?
I guess I did.
So as a huge Spike Spiegel fan, what are your thoughts on John Cho in the new live action Netflix?
Oh gosh, I am going to sit here and cross my fingers and hope for the best. I really do think that it's really going to pull through. And I think that's the biggest thing when we're talking about, you know, animes that might turn into live action. Your expectations are there, but you never know exactly how good it's going to be. So my hope is that he blows it out of the water because yes, I love Spike a ton. He's a great character that I feel is going to be hard for someone to fully encompass the actual character from the anime, but I have high hopes. So I'll be sitting on the edge of my seat, you know, kind of biting my fingers, wondering if this is going to be as great as I think it's going to be.
From what I've read in interviews, that because of his injury, he lived with the character Spike in his head for much longer than he would have otherwise. And it's my impression that he returned to the set with kind of this renewed sense of energy about Spike in general. And I'm really hoping that comes through in the latter episodes.
I do too. And I feel like when it comes to certain actors being able to fully encompass the character like that, you know, or some actors will sit there and they'll like, you know, eat, breathe, and sleep a character, like especially with actors that get really, really into their role. So my hopes are that, you know, he does come back and really, really grasp Spike.
I'm excited and nervous.
The song at the end of this movie is Gotta Knock a Little Harder. I really love the soundtrack to this movie. I love Ask DNA. I love how it opens. I love how it closes. And so if nothing else, after you listen to this podcast, go onto your favorite music player and turn on the soundtrack specifically for this movie. They created some great original stuff for it. And it's so good that it gives me hope for the Netflix version that if we have Yoko Kanno back, if she creates something as good as these songs, we'll get something positive out of the new version.
Holding out hope here.
Chisei, it's been so awesome hanging out with you, really applying some real-world science to a science fiction movie. If our followers wanted to see more of your work online, where would you like them to look?
Absolutely. It has been such a pleasure talking with you guys. I've enjoyed this so much and listening to you guys talk about the movie. I was like, man, it's like as if I'm watching it right now while we're discussing it. But yes, you can find me on Twitter. I am at Sailor Rue Scout. And that's actually the only website or social media that I use right now. It's just the easiest for me.
Well, I really enjoy all of your tweets. thank you for setting the record straight for so many misinformed people who just want answers. It's really a great service that you're doing, and we really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you. Just trying to help where I can and help people through this confusion and some madness going on right now.
Thank you so much for joining us. Next time on the Bebop Beat, another heavy episode. We discuss cults and extremism with Sarah Hightower on Brain Scratch. Thank you for listening to the Bebop Beat. If you like our show, please rate us on Apple or wherever you find your podcasts. Find us on Instagram and Twitter at Bebop Beat. Our email address is bebopbeatpodcast@gmail.com.
The Bebop Beat is hosted and produced by Jamie Sanchez and Lauren Fates. Our editor and associate producer is Angela Geis. Our logo and art assets are by Kat Janda.
I didn't know. It's saucy. Let's do it again.